country jobbers. And so that was the end of the shunters, effectively.
Was that within the stock exchange rules, you to deal outside with the country, the provincial stock exchanges?
Yes, they could definitely. Once we had the telephones, and country brokers would come on to us and deal direct. Oh, no, that was allowed. I always used to have my suspicions over the shunters. I think they kept two sets of books, although they always used to deny it. Because let's face it, if supposing that stock, which was offered in Birmingham at 7.5, and when we were bidding 9, well, supposing they'd taken it to Birmingham, and by the time they got to our pitch, we were only bidding 7.5, and they looked as if they were going easier. Well, the shunter would say, oh, all right, I'll sell them to you at 7.5. Well, he bought them at 7.5. And he was supposed to be charging a commission. So where was he? He was on a loss situation. What he wasn't allowed to be. I mean, he was acting as a principal, which he wasn't allowed to do. So I'm always convinced, although I never saw them, that he had two sets of books. And one to show the stock exchange, and one which was the actual prices at which he dealt. But they always denied it.
Now, about how big, Don, was the back office around the time of Big Bang?
Good grief, around the time of Big
Approximately.
Bang.
Approximately. Early 80s, I mean.
In the early 80s, let me think. We were about 300, and it was about half and half. I just think something like 150 people.
It must have been, yeah.
We had over 300 people in the firm, and we used to reckon it was about half and half.
And how would you contrast back office in the 1980s with the early 60s when you joined? Was it very different? Were you using different types of equipment?
Yes,
were you more sophisticated?
We'd started, the latter had started to computerise actually in 1961 when I joined the firm. We'd gone on to computerise systems because we realised that the way the back office was working was grossly, not inefficient, but within the system, it was very hard to maintain good delivery. And let's face it, we're talking about settlement now as opposed to the side that Roberts was concerned with. Settlement is all important, it's become more and more important now. Simply if people didn't get delivery of the stock, then they wouldn't pay for it, and your business would go broke very quickly. Mm. And it was certainly a cumbersome situation. One of the greatest developments was the Talisman settlement system within the stock exchange, which meant that was handled by the stock exchange itself, and where it apportioned the stock out so that people got delivery and they could pay for it quicker. Mm. Of course, since then, things have moved on apace, and there's now going to be a central depository where all the share certificates are going to be held, very similar to in New York. Which will increase and will make the situation much better. That is now, as you've heard, called Taurus. Mm-hmm. They're having problems within the stock exchange with Taurus, but the thoughts are in the business that we're obviously in the City of London now very keen that come 1992 we are seen as the centre of the business empire, if you like, throughout the world. Obviously, Frankfurt have got different ideas, Paris and, of course, Rome have got different ideas about that. I'm very optimistic about that side, but there's no doubt about it, one of the things that will harm us is the fact that we have quite an archaic settlement system at the moment. We've got to do something about that, and that's what they're working. They're pulling out all the stops now, and if you ever hear anything from the stock exchange, they are working very hard on the settlement side of the business. Mm. It's no good you selling shares if you don't get payment for them. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Was there a particular partner in WID who was responsible for the oversight of the administration?
Yes. Yes. Well, there was a chap called Les Turtle, who, there again, was, as we've said earlier on, was a very forceful personality, a very, very intelligent man, but was very, was blunt to the point of, you know, I think, whatever you say. As I said, it was not a business for anybody who was a timid nature, and you had to be very forceful with a lot of people to get your point made. Having said that, there was never, one of the greatest things I think you can say about the stock exchange as it was then, and I always say to when I talk to youngsters coming in, if you at the end of your career, whatever you're going to do, can say with your hand on your heart, I never ever once looked at the clock and thought to myself, oh my goodness, there's another 2 hours to go before I go home. Gotcha. The only reason you ever looked at the clock was to think, so crying out loud, I've got to get a move on. And if you can say that at the end of the day, you've been forceful. That was the way the business was And I can say that with my hand on my heart. I never ever looked at the clock and thought, oh my goodness, another 2 hours to go. Mm. Having said that, the downside was that you had a lot of very, very forthright people. We had to be forthright because if you got £50 million worth of stock to pay in before 3 o'clock, then you hadn't got the time for niceties. That was the way it was.
And I think the market side was very similar, actually. You know, I mean, you used to look forward, you know, look forward to Monday morning, and especially in those days, you used to have a lot of sort of newspaper tips. And if one of the stocks you dealt in was tipped, well, you knew you were going to be busy, and it was great. And even if you were short of stock and it was tipped, you reckon on the whole, well, you get it back, as I explained to you before. And it was fun. And you look forward to it. And okay, you got tired at the end of the week if you've been very busy, and you undoubtedly were, and you'd think, oh, well, we can collapse now, have a few beers and go home. But no, it was fun. And I think that's rather sad. I think you've got to have fun in life, and I just question whether they have quite as much fun as we used to have. And people talk about, I always used to think the Stock Exchange was a place where the grown men used to sort of behave like children, throw paper balls around and this and that. Well, I always think that that was part of a sort of safety mechanism for people, because they could be under very great pressure at times. And if you've got a book which is costing you a lot of money, and it gets you in the guts, it can do, and that's why some people, quite a few people who I can think of broking now, who have been with our firm, and they just weren't cut out, it wasn't in their personality to be jobbers. It takes I think you have to have a slightly sort of cavalier attitude to life to do it, but not let it get at you. And you're superhuman if it's some stage or other it doesn't get at you, and you think, well, can I ever do anything right? Am I ever going to make a profit again? But you've got to ride that, and one of the ways you rode it was because you knew that most likely your opposition was in a similar state. It was very unlikely that you would have a different book from him if it had really gone badly. You'd all have been caught. And so you could joke it out with him and talk to them, and the brokers understood this. So there was a very great sort of camaraderie, if you like, and friendship between the dealers, brokers and jobbers. Dealers.
What were the other qualities required to be a jobber? To be a successful jobber?
Good heavens, I don't know. You better answer that, Tom.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I was actually responsible towards the end of my career in WED for the recruiting of market makers. Some people, that's the question I'm always asked, how on earth did you ever recruit a market maker? I have to say, I had quite a bit of success at that, and Graham Ferguson also, who's coming in, will tell you he was responsible as well. The simple answer is, you could never ever tell whether anybody was going to be good at a market maker until you actually trade them. We in WED had a 2-year training period for these people. Before they were allowed to trade, they had to be in the office 2 years, and we had ran a system where I used to put them around the back office, because I always felt it was important, or it was felt within WED, let me put it that way, it was important that these people knew how to settle the business. If they knew if something had happened, that they were going to have to settle that business, it was possible for them to know. But to become a market maker, let me just give you for instance, it would probably not be right to say that a graduate would make a good market maker. Because market making is, to put it in vulgar terms, was a gut reaction to a situation.
Seat of the pants.
Yeah. If you were analytical, I mean, it's not being derogatory to all market makers, and Robert will agree, but if you were taught analytical, what are they now? They're 150, 152, I'll sell you 10,000, what are they now? Well, if I make if I do that, then they'll know. So you'd lost, you've had it. I mean, we had partners who would go around the floor and say, what's your position in such and such a thing? Cut it, get rid of it. And you had to do that because the risk was considered then too great. And you had to be, so it's very difficult. Having said that, one of their best dealers was a chap, Woods, who came. He was brilliant, he was a graduate, he was a brilliant dealer. And some of the people I was constantly proved wrong, where people I would think, well, certainly if I interviewed you in the first instance and you were a bit of a nervous disposition, I always used to say, Robert has said, certainly you had to be cavalier, but I always used to say to people, there's this sort of, not temporary insanity, but there's this slightly eccentricity running your family, because I always used to think that anybody who chose that as a career had to be slightly eccentric, not in a nasty way, but you had to have an unorthodox view of what life was about. And I think that's certainly true for the hours and the pressure that you put yourself under. I mean, why would people put themselves and queue up to put themselves under this sort of pressure?
I think certainly in the old market, there's no doubt about it, you needed to be some sort of personality, and you needed to be able to get on with people. That was most important, because otherwise, if you were just a sort of shrew or a mouse, nobody, they'd either ride roughshod over you, and it would get to you. I mean, you had to be a bit of an extrovert, I think, to be a jobber. Sure you did.
Did you ever get someone sent onto your pitch as a blue button who you thought was quite a dud, and you couldn't actually work out why on earth they'd sent you person?
Yes, you did. And we had quite a heavy turnover, and of course it was in their interest. And I can think of, as I say, I was with one yesterday actually who used to be blue button with us, and he's done very well since he went brokey. But I mean, he just wasn't cut out for it. And I can think of many partners' sons who were just not cut out for it. And so they came into the firm, and it was very difficult. And you had to sort of say to the father, perhaps, I'm terribly sorry, I just don't think you're going to make it. But there's no point in going on and doing something. Because if you're not good at it, you won't enjoy it. And I mean, what's the point? I mean, you're going to be good at something else. But it was, one had plenty.
Don, when did a firm like Wed have to start thinking seriously about recruitment?
When did they think seriously about recruitment?
Yes, for example, did they have a recruitment program when you first joined?
Well, they obviously had a recruitment program, but they because they employed people. But no, it was, I think, I don't take credit. You've got some gentlemen coming in and some gentlemen here that probably take credit for this, but we were actually the first organisation in the Stock Exchange. And I was part and parcel of that, which I took on from a chap called Paul Daniel, who actually felt it necessary to have a training programme. Mm-hmm. And we set up a very, very comprehensive training programme, mm-hmm. which, in fact, I have actually taken into BZW, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. And we thought that was necessary, and we thought, going 10 years before Big Bang, mm-hmm. 73, where we thought it was necessary to talk to people from outside, whereas a lot of the firms said, well, what do we want to talk? There's nothing. What's in it for us? That wasn't the case at WED. 10 years ago, I was actually receiving people into WED from other businesses, and it's funny how it comes back. I see those people again now, and they phone me now in BZW. It's quite extraordinary. Joel Dennis will probably tell you when he comes in the effect that this has had, where you take time to talk to the press. And it's a follow-on from what we did at WED, where we would take time to talk to the press or take time to talk to people from institutions or from universities. And that wasn't something that we suddenly thought we'd better do this. That was done well before there was any thought of deregulation. A recruiting policy, well, we used to at that time, you've got to bear in mind that we were extremely busy, and you tended to take people, if you could get them, if they had any sort of experience at all. And it happened again, of course, at Big Bang, where there was such a shortage of very good staff that you actually took people if they got some experience. Mm-hmm. But our recruiting programme, and the training program took effect certainly 10 years, a good 10 years prior to Big Bang, mm-hmm. where we thought there was a necessity. Mm. We never knew that things were going to happen the way they did. Mm. And we were the only firm in the Stock Exchange. In fact, we were responsible for, believe it or not, we used to have a very nice chore, which I used to do, where we used to have the Stock Exchange gallery guides come round to WED for 3 days, and I used to sit and talk
to them. Oh, that's right, yes, it did.
When they were asked the question, what is happening on the trading floor, and we used to get them to go down to Robert and stand there just to get the feel of it. They used to have a special pass, and we used to do that. We were the only firm that ever did. Mm-hmm. Most of the gallery guys were trained by Wed the Lacquer, not the Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. There was a foresight there.
Do you think that distinguished Wed the Lacquer from the other jobbing firms on the Stock Exchange? I suppose another way of putting that question is, if someone had asked you in 1980, 81, what you thought was distinctive about Wed the Lacquer, what would you have said, Robert?
Oh dear. I think we had and this was inculcated, I think, right from the start by Esmond de Lacquer. I think we had a great sense of responsibility to the industry, if that's the right word. I think we felt that we did owe it a duty, that we didn't do badly out of it, and therefore it was up to us to try and put something back into it. I think that would sum it up as far as I'm concerned. We may not have been, we were pretty commercial, but there were some firms who I mean, I have a very healthy regard for Tony Lewis and Smith Brothers as they were then. They were a very healthy competition to us, and times far too healthy. But I think they did look after themselves quite a lot.
How would you answer that question,
John? I think that earlier on we talked about McClintock, was it?
McKinsey's,
sorry, I keep getting it wrong. McKinsey's, why, I mean, I can answer that question, why didn't we take their advice and pack up trading? And I think it goes back much, much before that. I mean, it sounds terrible to say it now, and people will say in years to come when we're perhaps no longer here, somebody will be, I don't believe that, that's impossible. But I can remember Sir Nigel Mordaunt, going back to the times before Wendell Acker, Sir Nigel Mordaunt, at a meeting, saying when we were thinking of doing certain things that are done now offhand in industry, where great size of industry are made redundant and laid bare, I can remember Sir Nigel Mordaunt saying, we have to remember we've got 300 staff here. That's not 300 people that are responsible to us. That's 12 or 1500 people, because we're talking about the families. And when you think of that, and because that will affect them, we're not going to do it. And we run situations, loss leaders, if you like, when they should really, from good, I'm not saying they were bad businessmen, but I think there was definitely, from my point of view, going back to those days, there was a definite feeling of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that the firm had grown up and it was like a family. And you didn't do that sort of thing. Now, of course, that has changed, quite rightly, probably. We've got to be professional to counteract the challenge that we're getting from abroad, and that sort of thing probably nowadays would not be good enough, but certainly I can remember that going back to those days. Mm-hmm. There was that feeling that if we had left the stock exchange, and I can say that, if we at that day of Durlacher and in Wed had pulled out of the stock exchange, it would have been disastrous for the stock exchange and for the financial institutes in the City of London. Mm-hmm. And I think it was what I said earlier on, when you think of the Conservative government at that time should have been on our side, and I think that the really when Parkinson came and made, he had that fully in mind.
Now, I've been told, rightly or wrongly, that in the immediate last years of single capacity, the last years of a physical marketplace, a lot of the old standards seemed to go, and a lot of firms tried to position themselves competitively for the new situation. Does that chime with your own experience?
Yes, I think it did, because there were the conventions, you know, that you didn't take up stocks. There were the agreed. It was normally assumed and worked out, part of what I was saying before, that if you had three good jobbers in a market, well, that was enough to make an efficient market. But towards the end, before Big Bang, you had new firms taking up, or some of the old firms taking up. I mean, for instance, Smith took up breweries. Well, they were going to be dual capacity, so it was no use them saying they didn't deal in breweries. And if somebody rang up and said they wanted a deal, I mean, they'd got to be dealing in virtually everything. And so all that convention went. Yes, I think the gloves came off rather before Big Bang, and those niceties, and they did disappear.
Were you continuing as a jobber on the floor of the stock exchange right up to 1986?
No. Dick and I came off, I can't remember when it was, 84.
About then.
We were overseeing, in any case. We were overseeing, I suppose, what did I say, I forget it, 83, 4, something like that. We were overseeing the industrial equity market. We weren't actually running books, but we were seeing the figures that Don was producing every morning and watching them very closely. And we weren't actually running a book, unlike the old senior partners were in those days, who, you know, who would actually jump from the front, so to speak.
Yeah, you were responsible for a collection of pitches. Well,
that's right. Yes.
Not a market official, but we
no, that tied, was afterwards.
We had a
tied yes, that's right.
Dealing executive who was responsible then for keeping an eye on what the lads.
All the group of partners who were running that, we were in charge of that.
With the power to say, I think that bull position is too large, cut it. And they had to do it there, and they called the price down until they cut it because the indebtedness was too great.
Would you say the actual art of jobbing, the mechanics of standing on the floor of the house in 1984 was different to what it had been in the late 1950s when you had first worked as a dealer?
Well, funny enough, no, I don't think it had changed that amount. I mean, you stood, you didn't sit, because it was, deemed, I like to talk eyeball to eyeball to something, to somebody, so they were standing up. You had a seat, but you normally stood up. And they came to you and they asked the price. And of course, one of the advantages of the jobbing system was that, from our point of view, that you had a board, rather like a bookies board, with all your stocks on it. And it didn't have the two-way price, it just had a middle price, say, the pound, Sainsbury's, whatever they were, 250. And it was an indication. But you had the flexibility. Supposing you were short of stock and there was a broker who suddenly saw him coming, and you had been calling them 47.52 or 48.52, and you thought, I'm about a quarter of a million of those. He's always a buyer, this chap. I think we might make him 50 to 4. Then say you could. You could even make 52.6 if you wanted to. He would know most likely that you were shooting him, which was what it was called. And occasionally there was a rather crude expression which said that he who shoots gets shat upon. Well, what actually would happen was you'd do that. And you'd misread him, and he said, "I'll sell you." So he called the price out from what you were going to be. But
that was the safeguard.
But that was part of the fun of it. Now you see, the market maker has to be up there. His price is firm. Everybody, his rivals, and he can see it. And he's up there at 48.52. But he can't change it. The only way he can change it is if he sees his rivals changing it, and he hopes the phone hasn't gone by the time he's changed it. Mm-hmm. But we could do that, just by seeing something. And of course, the other pressure which I think it puts on the market makers these days is that those prices have got to be up there live. And they may not have dealt for 3 or 4 hours, maybe in a couple of days, but the price is live. Whereas we used to sort of occasionally, if it was an unmarketable stock, you'd sort of pick up the book and have a look at it. And I mean, normally you'd make the price straight out, but if you hadn't dealt it, if they were very unmarketable, they did. They picked up the book and they looked at their limits and then made a price. Now they've got to be up there. And if you're dealing in 200 stocks, keeping 200 stocks up there live, where you could be hit at any second, there's a hell of a strain on people, I think.
Don, from your perspective in the back office over, well, more than 20 years, would you say that jobbing had changed from the point of view of the administration, from the point of view of stats and so on?
Has it changed? Well, I suppose at the time of Big Bang, things obviously changed. I'm one of those that I think the old days were good old days, but I'm not one of those that would knock the system we have now. I think the system that we've got now is going to stand us in very good stead for 1992. No, the basic principle, I'm one of those. I actually, although some of the market makers disagree with me, but I think that to, not just from back office point of view, settlement side, we've discussed the changes that have got to come there, but I believe it's absolutely necessary within the organisation now, and I'm open to contradiction here, that people, when they put the prices on the CX screen, understand how those prices get on there. Because we're going to quickly come to a situation where we're going to have market makers now in our organisation who have never stood on the floor of the stock exchange. Mm. I think that there will be a great loss, and one of the things I do, and I'm very particular to do, if people come in and I talk to people, is to explain to them how prices used to be made, because I don't think that you can show them a CX screen and get them to understand what they're seeing on that screen unless you realise what goes in to putting those prices on the screen. Now, there are people from WED who disagree with me in that, but I believe that's absolutely necessary. It's not changed all that much. The for the market making, of course, you're not doing face-to-face, whereas Robert's said you could see somebody coming and I will do this now, you pick the phone up. As far as the back office is concerned, well, the running of the office in BZW, it's not so personal as it was.
But nothing is it?
Nothing.
Sadly.
No, nothing's gone. I mean,
that was the fun of it, the marketplace. Yeah. A market creates an atmosphere. It's like going to an auction. And people do silly things at auctions. They pay more than they thought they were going to. Mm-hmm. And there's an atmosphere. And you could always tell how much business there was by walking in there, you by the sound and the level of noise of people talking and dealing. You could think, oh well, you know, the place is dead. There's nothing going on. That, and of course, I mean, you looked at the boards and they were covered in red or blue or whatever. So you could gauge if there was activity there and people rushing in and out. And it was fun, but
Well, I think we'll finish on that reasonably bright note. Yeah. Thank you very much.